Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So, as I mentioned a few days ago, we're going to be moving back to doing a few more readings on contemplation of feeling, vedana, and contemplation of mind, cittanupassana. And so I thought I'd just start, just to refresh us again, with just reading a bit of the introduction to the contemplation of feelings that's in Bhikkhu Anālayo's Satipatthana book, just to get back on the same page, and then go from there with some from mostly sutta readings. There's a few classics that are out there with both from the Majjhima Nikaya and also the Vedana Saṅyutta in the Saṅyutta Nikaya collection. So we'll just do some sutta, good old sutta reading. But first, the introduction here. Refreshment of what vedana is. The Pali term for feeling is vedana, derived from the word vedeti, which means both to feel and to know. In its usage in the discourses, vedana comprises both bodily and mental feelings. Vedana does not include emotion in its range of meaning. Although emotions arise depending on the initial input provided by feeling, they are more complex mental phenomena than bare feeling itself, and are therefore rather the domain of the next satipatthana, contemplation of states of mind. The satipatthana instructions for contemplation of feelings are, and this is the from the Satipatthana Sutta, when feeling a pleasant feeling, he knows, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling an unpleasant feeling, he knows, I feel an unpleasant feeling. When feeling a neutral feeling, he knows, I feel a neutral feeling. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, he knows, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he knows, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly unpleasant feeling, he knows, I feel a worldly unpleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly unpleasant feeling, he knows, I feel an unworldly unpleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly neutral feeling, he knows I feel a worldly neutral feeling. When feeling an unworldly neutral feeling, he knows, I feel an unworldly neutral feeling. The first part of the above instructions distinguishes between three basic kinds of feelings: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. According to the discourses, developing understanding and detachment in regard to these feelings has the potential to lead to freedom from dukkha. Since such understanding can be gained through the practice of satipatthana, contemplation of feelings is a meditation practice of considerable potential. This potential is based on the simple but ingenious method of directing awareness to the very first stages of the arising of likes and dislikes. By clearly noting whether the present moment's experience is felt as pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. Thus, to contemplate feelings means quite literally to know how one feels, and this with such immediacy that the light of awareness is present before the onset of reactions, projections, or justifications in regard to how one feels. Undertaken in this way, contemplation of feelings will reveal the surprising degree to which one's attitudes and reactions are based on this initial affective input provided by feelings. The systematic development of such immediate knowing will also strengthen one's more intuitive modes of apperception, in the sense of the ability to get a feel for a situation or another person. This ability offers a helpful additional source of information in everyday life, complementing the information gained through more rational modes of observation and consideration. Apperception is one of Ajahn Sumedho's favorite words in the past few years. Apperception. Yeah. So I've heard him use it quite a few times, sort of referring to that. He uses it, and also Analia uses it in that kind of sense of an intuitive mode of perception. I also looked it up in the dictionary a while back, and it seemed to have a slightly different meaning in terms of taking perceptions and then incorporating them into one's own experience is kind of how it was defined. It's a historical thing. It's not a word that's used very much in modern times. Anyway,
probably didn't use that much
in there. Probably isn't a lot of intuitive perception going on. In the Satipatthana instructions, mindfulness of these three feelings is followed by directing awareness to an additional subdivision of feelings into worldly, samisa, and unworldly, niramisa. According to a passage in the Anguttara Nikaya, this sixfold classification represents the range of diversity in feelings. Thus, with this sixfold scheme, contemplation of feeling comprehensively surveys the whole scale of diversity of the phenomenon feeling. The distinction between worldly and unworldly feelings is concerned with the difference between feelings related to the flesh and feelings related to renunciation. This additional dimension revolves around an evaluation of feeling that is based not on its affective nature, but more on the ethical context of its arising. The basic point introduced here is awareness of whether a particular feeling is related to progress or regress on the path. Unlike his ascetic contemporaries, the Buddha did not categorically reject all pleasant feelings, nor did he categorically recommend unpleasant experiences for their supposedly purifying effect. Instead, he placed emphasis on the mental and ethical consequences of all types of feeling. With the help of the above sixfold classification, this ethical dimension becomes apparent, uncovering in particular the relation of feelings to the activation of latent mental tendency, anusaya, towards lust, irritation, or ignorance. As the Chula Vedala Sutta points out, the arising of these underlying tendencies is mainly related to the three worldly types of feelings, whereas unworldly pleasant or neutral feelings arising during deep concentration, or unworldly unpleasant feelings arising owing to dissatisfaction with one's spiritual imperfection, do not stimulate these underlying tendencies. So I'll leave it there for that, just as a way of introduction. And I thought I would read those very good excerpts from the Chula Vedala Sutta that he was referring to. And there aren't any, if there's any, unless there's some questions or comments right now before we move on.
Hopefully your comment is what is translated as worldly and unworldly, samisa and niramisa. Sort of amisa because when they say of the flesh, I mean, it is actually meat that you put on a hook for catching fish or catching things. Mm. It's actually, I mean, that's its root or its usage. So it's actually, it's kind of the bait. with the bait and without the bait.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So that samanisa is without, and it's a bait. Nearness without debate. It's like it's quite a descriptive term that is a bit, glossed by worldly.
Unworldly, right. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Yeah, I think I've seen it also translate sometimes as carnal.
You know? Right. But even that is has a very Christian perspective and
judgmental.
The Buddha's it's a bit more down to earth in that sense. So yeah, it's what you bite onto to get hooked on something.
Jacob, you had a...
I'm curious regarding pleasures of renunciation, such as like meditation, piti sukha.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
The pleasant feeling that's associated with any wholesome pursuit in developing the path.
Yeah, actually, there's a whole range in the sense of generosity, the fruits of generosity, loving kindness, virtue.
Yeah.
Those are.
Pain pills. It's a lot of things.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, what bliss.
Oh, what bliss, right?
How about some examples of, I think it was mentioned in the introduction, unworldly, unpleasant.
Yeah, just like the one that he mentioned there would be like oh, you know, when will it be that I will be, enlightened? When will I realize the fruits of the path? I haven't done it yet. It's like an unpleasant feeling, a wish for what we don't have in the spiritual sense.
Yeah, I think also sometimes the aspects of restraint are unpleasant feelings, but that's not knowingly taken on, even though it feels uncomfortable, but you know your purpose and your goal and you see the benefits come from it.
The dukkha that leads to the end of dukkha.
Yeah, dukkha that leads to the end of dukkha.
Just checking that last sentence, he's saying that the pleasure from worldly pleasant feeling and the desire for that is not coming from the underlying tendencies. Is that correct?
Say again, the desire for
unworldly pleasant feeling is not related to underlying tendencies. That's what I heard.
The underlying tendencies towards like lust, aversion, delusion, yeah, that it's related to a loftier aspiration, yeah.
Underlying tendencies for aspiration.
Kind of the chanda versus the tanha.
Yeah, chanda versus tanha, kind of gears of being engaged. I don't think they use it so much in Thai.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's an idiom in Thai.
Amit Sinjang,
but it's usually when it's used in Thai. Then oftentimes it's referring to material goods, but it isn't used in its say its Dhamma context.
Mm.
Okay.
So they just use the word amit.
Yes. Tapsa.
Go ahead and read some excerpts from the Chulavedala Sutta. This is Majjhima Nikaya number 44, the shorter series of questions and answers between the lay follower Visakha and the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina, who actually prior to her ordination They were husband and wife. And I think he's now a non-returner?
He's a non-returner.
Layman, and she's a Arahant Bhikkhuni. Just for a little background here. So I won't read the whole sutta because it goes into some other areas that are different from Vedana, but there's a section on questions and answers relating to Vedana, feeling. It begins with, Lady, how many kinds of feeling are there? Friend Visakha, there are three kinds of feeling, pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling. But lady, what is pleasant feeling? What is painful feeling? What is neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, whatever is felt bodily or mentally as pleasant and soothing is pleasant feeling. Whatever is felt bodily or mentally as painful and hurting is painful feeling. Whatever is felt bodily or mentally as neither soothing nor hurting is neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Lady, what is pleasant and what is painful in regard to pleasant feeling? What is painful and what is pleasant in regard to painful feeling? What is pleasant and what is painful in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, pleasant feeling is pleasant when it persists and painful when it changes. Painful feeling is painful when it persists and pleasant when it changes. Neither painful nor pleasant feeling is pleasant when there is knowledge of it, and painful when there is no knowledge of it. And just pause right there. I just think that's a really very, very useful exchange in pointing out the rapidity with which feelings change. Very quickly, something pleasant becomes painful. Very quickly, something that's painful becomes pleasant. And a whole wide range of, what is sort of considered neutral in between. And that the actual unknowing, the not knowing of something that's relatively neutral is in itself not a, it's just, ignorance is not a pleasant state of mind. It's knowledge and mindfulness in and of itself is a pleasant experience, even if it's of a neutral feeling. So I just thought that was a very astute exchange there. Lady, what underlying tendency underlies pleasant feeling? What underlying tendency underlies painful feeling? What underlying tendency underlies neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Again, underlying tendency is anusaya. Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust underlies pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion underlies painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance underlies neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Lady, does the underlying tendency to lust underlie all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion underlie all painful feeling? Does the underlying tendency to ignorance underlie all neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust does not underlie all pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie all painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance does not underlie all neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Lady, what should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Lady, does the underlying tendency to lust have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling? Does the underlying tendency to ignorance have to be abandoned in regard to all neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust does not have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion does not have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance does not have to be abandoned in regard to all neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Here, friend Visakha, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. With that he abandons lust, and the underlying tendency to lust does not underlie that. Here a bhikkhu considers thus, when shall I enter upon and abide in that base that the noble ones now enter upon and abide in? In one who thus generates a longing for the supreme liberations, grief arises with that longing as condition. With that, he abandons aversion, and the underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie that. Here, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. With that, he abandons ignorance, and the underlying tendency to ignorance does not underlie that. Lady, what is the counterpart of pleasant feeling? And actually, I'm going to read the footnote on that because I think it helps explain the use of that term, counterpart, in the next few phrases, if I remember right. The word counterpart is used to express the relationships of both opposition and supplementation, which will make sense when I read it. So, lady, what is the counterpart of pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, painful feeling is the counterpart of pleasant feeling. So that's an example of an opposite in the use of the word counterpart. What is the counterpart of painful feeling? Pleasant feeling is the counterpart of painful feeling. Again, the opposite. What is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Ignorance is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So that's an example of where counterpart is used as a supplement. Ignorance and neutral feeling are related to each other as counterparts. What is the counterpart of ignorance? True knowledge is the counterpart of ignorance. What is the counterpart of true knowledge? Deliverance is the counterpart of true knowledge. What is the counterpart of deliverance? Nibbana is the counterpart of deliverance. Lady, what is the counterpart of Nibbana? Friend Visakha, you have pushed this line of questioning too far. You are not able to grasp the limit to questions. For the holy life, friend Visakha, is grounded upon Nibbana, culminates in Nibbana, ends in Nibbana. If you wish, friend Visakha, go to the Blessed One and ask him about the meaning of this. As the Blessed One explains it to you, so you should remember it. Then the follower Visakha, having delighted and rejoiced in the bhikkhuni Dhammadina's words, rose from his seat and, after paying homage to her, kept her on his right. He went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One his entire conversation with the bhikkhuni Dhammadina. When he finished speaking, the Blessed One told him, "The bhikkhuni Dhammadina is wise, Visakha. The bhikkhuni Dhammadina has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that the bhikkhuni Dhammadina has explained it. Such is its meaning, and so you should remember it." That is what the Blessed One said. The lay follower, Visakha, was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. And I think Dhammadina was the bhikkhuni foremost in wisdom. Is that right? Or foremost?
I don't think so. No.
No?
I think...
She was foremost in something. Wasn't
she? She's definitely foremost in something. I think Kama, I think,
is foremost. I don't remember what. Okay. have to find out what Dhammadina was. I'll have to find out what Dhammadina was foremost in.
Yeah, see what the...
Oh, and maybe in the introduction.
Right at the beginning is
a... Maybe so. 459.
Because it might put it in the footnotes.
Yeah.
Which is foremost, yeah.
Succinctness.
Ah. Let's see, I'll just read the whole footnote. Visakha was a wealthy merchant of Rajagaha and a non-returner. Dhammadina, his former wife in lay life, had attained arahantship soon after her ordination as a bhikkhuni. She was declared by the Buddha the foremost bhikkhuni disciple in expounding the Dhamma. Okay, any comments or questions on that exchange? It's one of my favorite suttas, actually.
Well, it just occurs to me how much pain there can be in the not knowing neutral feeling, since we're wired for pleasant and aversion. That's quite a lot of potential dukkha.
Well, yeah, and then also, you know, the reality is the majority of our feeling is neutral. But, you know, we kind of flop around like fish out of water and neutral feeling. That's sukha, and trying to get something. Grab a purchase, give me some feeling, give me something clear.
We spent most of our time in neutral feeling, looking for pleasant feeling.
Yeah. Well, would it be safe to say that neutral feeling is where delusion tends to rest?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely the underlying tendency.
It's home base.
Yeah, it's, and as we'll see in more of the readings tomorrow as we go on, it's just really, I think everybody probably gets the idea that the contemplation of feeling is so important because it's the link, say, in dependent origination that is immediately prior to craving. So it's the basis for tanha. Bhavatana, vibhavatana, kamatana. It's that constant craving for pleasant feeling or to avoid painful feeling that keeps us going, in the craving, clinging, becoming, birth, suffering, old age, sickness, and death cycle. So, catching it at this phase of it before it starts to snowball is a very important part of the practice.
It may be part of your subsequent reading, but as Longpa mentioned in the talk the other night, that the Pali grammar and the Honeyball Sutta indicates that self is like feeling is where itself sort of manifests around.
It starts to. To form. Yeah, we're actually the Honeyball Sutta is coming up.
The actual feeling is a natural part of our experience. So it doesn't really have any karmic potency, but it's our reaction to feeling that is the plants the seeds for that karma.
The generation.
Generating of karmic results.
Yeah. Say, is it right?
That's actually what they, when, because sometimes you'll see the, you know, that, those 12 links of the dependent origination, and some of them are kamma conditions, and some of them are
vipaka, that's what I was just going to say. And feeling is considered to be vipaka rather than kamma.
Feeling is a vipaka condition. It's a result. And the next link after feeling is tanha. That is a kamma condition. It's creating kamma.
Nibbana, is that, would it be when the chitta chatter stops permanently, unless you decide to have directed thought? And then, because some of the formless states, they aren't really, you can't really function around other people in them. So I assume you wouldn't ever stay in those states. You would go in them and come out.
You have sort of a multi-leveled question there.
Yeah. I'm trying to understand. I don't know, like, what are we shooting for here?
Well, I, first of all, I will almost immediately defer any questions regarding Nibbana to Lung Pa. But one thing that immediately comes to mind is that looking for a thoughtless state of mind is not the goal, necessarily. Looking for freedom from suffering, which when completely realized is you know, the experience of Nibbana. So that's whether there are thoughts or experiences in the mind isn't necessarily relevant to one who has attained arahantship.
Okay.
But I will.
Yeah, I think Ajahn Chah sort of asking, just sitting around asking, you know, who's the only person who doesn't think? You know, and they said, Paul, is this an arahant? No, it's a Buddha? No. Yes. I don't know, who is it? And the only person who doesn't think is a dead person.
Can't say it any better than that. Can't say it any better than
right.
that.
So I'd say saying that there's the goal. Because oftentimes that's how we conceive of the. There's a logical axiom in the sense, you know, I think, therefore I suffer. So, you know, and it's, you know, logically, so if I didn't think, then I wouldn't suffer. So, but that's not actually the point in terms of Dhamma, because it's sort of it's whether the thinking is in line with Dhamma or not in line with Dhamma that conditions whether they're suffering or not. So it's learning those skills of understanding and relinquishing around the thought processes that frees the heart from suffering. That is the distinguishing characteristic of Nibbana.
And just quickly, in regards to your reference to the immaterial states, it's like those are, you know, very high states of concentration where there isn't necessarily like verbal thought occurring, but those are all temporary conditioned states of mind that are based on, you know, very deep states of concentration, and eventually one will come out of that, whether it's, you know, in the you know, after the particular meditation is over or at the end of a very long lifetime in that particular realm. but it is still a conditioned state of mind. Is there another question?
Well, I was just going to say that in regard to sila, it seems that it requires quite a bit of thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. You think of certainly sila and the monastic discipline definitely requires a whole ranges of thinking, reflection, considering, committing to memory. Those are again habits, skillfully, their basis of Because even that, like an arahant can commit offenses or do things. And some of them can't, of course, but those are there's lapses of mindfulness or lapses of judgment that are possible.
Okay.
Namayam dhammakataya sarva dharam dadamase
sa